She wrote to Larry Bachman, who apologized for the difficulties over Murder Ahoy, and attempted to reassure her as to the ABC murders. "Please be assured that our basic conception of Hercule Poirot is such that it will not diminish the pride in your creation of this world-famous character. We will not make him a licentious, girl-chasing, dirty or shabby character." "Soft words butter no parsnips," began her reply, and if this flummoxed Bachman, then the rest of the letter was admirably clear. "I still feel it questionable that you really have the right to act as you have done." Cork did his best to restrain any future excesses on the part of MGM, but it was a losing battle, and he knew it. "No film company will surrender absolute control," he wrote to Anthony in May 1964. But Agatha was also obdurate. The films had gone from bad to worse. In fact, they had become demeaning, and there was no prospect that MGM would ever treat the books with any kind of respect. It was stalemate. In July 1965, Cork delivered the news that MGM have not scheduled any further cinema films, as they find it impracticable to proceed without some more flexible arrangement as to adaptation than we are willing to grant them. To Rosalind he wrote, "It is a relief to be free of MGM." The company had also employed Agatha to write an adaptation of Bleak House, one of her favourite novels, for which she, or Agatha Christie Limited, was paid £10,000 in 1962. She found the work fascinating, but had been subject to constant interference. She said that she had never got headaches from worry over her work before as with this, wrote A.L. Rouse. The film was never made. So the MGM deal had not yet yielded the promised riches, and the Cheney case, which had been awaiting judgment since 1957, went against her. In November 1964, Cork wrote, "I need not say how sorry I was to have to tell you last night that we lost our case against the special commissioners." She was now liable for a sum between £100,000 and £125,000, this being the tax arrears from 1955. Agatha may indeed be shaken when she comes to consider the amounts at stake. Cork wrote to Anthony. He himself was extremely upset about it and felt deeply frustrated at his own failure to protect her. He attempted reassurance. "In my view, the copyrights that we reserved against contingencies are worth substantially more than these sums," he told her. "But of course, they had to be sold without proceeds incurring tax at 18 shillings in the pound." The old spectre of bankruptcy raised its head. "You would be gloriously solvent," he wrote tentatively. Then he moved away from his frankly unbelievable idea. "I am more than ever confident that a solution will be found that will not scrape the barrel and which should not force any alteration in your mode of living. If you decide you want to cut down a bit anyway, that is a different matter." It was a desperate shambles. Although it was nobody's fault, except that of the rapacious revenue, it was a cruel position for Agatha to be in. The decision was appealed, and the appeal was lost. More money was paid, more demanded. As a younger woman, Agatha had had the resilience to withstand the situation, the sheer relentlessness with which it drove back and forth across her life. But in her 70s, she found it hard, although she put up a show of courage. "Now that the unmentionable financial year has come round again," she wrote to Cork in March 1966, "will you send me my accounts so that I can keep up with my homework and know how I stand and why? I don't know how or what I am spending, and I find this worrying. So will you do this, as you have the figures and I don't? I can't say 1966 has been a pleasant year so far. Thank you for enclosed accounts. I can't help grudging Medley," one of her legal advisers. "Talk, talk, talk, object, and no good comes of it." In October 1966, a meeting was held at Somerset House, at which her liability was assessed as somewhere near £200,000. but it was agreed that she could sell her retained copyrights for £150,000 to Agatha Christie Limited without incurring tax. Agatha was in America at the time and replied from Princeton. "Nice to receive your letter, though I must say I am far from sharing your inexplicable jubilation. If the tax people can tell me to sell my copyrights to Agatha Christie Company, they are sitting pretty to collect nearly all of the sum received for ordinary income tax, and no doubt would. Why not? They are entitled to it. No, I'm not rejoicing yet. We are enjoying ourselves very much." Eventually, a solution of sorts was found when 51% of Agatha Christie Limited was sold in 1968. It was bought by Booker McConnell, the company that in 1972 established the Booker Prize, a subsidiary of which had bought a similar controlling stake in Ian Fleming and the James Bond books. The sum paid to Agatha Christie Limited was unspecified, but reported as being very much more than the £100,000 deal with Fleming. By 1972, Booker also acquired the interest in the copyrights that had been owned by the Christie Copyrights Trust. The company then lent to Agatha the money she owed to the revenue, the loan being secured by the copyrights she retained. So it was that in her 80s, she was in personal debt to Booker McConnell, but clear of her obligations to the Inland Revenue. Relieved at last of a weight that had pressed upon her horribly by the end for more than 30 years. What has been called the mystery of her will, the fact that she left only £106,000, was in fact no mystery at all. Everything else had been taken from her. Throughout, Rosalind's attitude was complex, as always between her and her mother. For a start, her views on her mother's writing was far from straightforward. Like Agatha, she loathed publicity, because she too lived with the fallout of 1926, because her nature was so down to earth and suspicious of flummery, and what conjured more publicity than the words of Agatha Christie. The plays in particular attracted a huge amount of public attention. The Mary Westmacott's were obviously autobiographical, which was why in later life Rosalind was at pains to stress that they were not. According to her son, she rather wished the Westmacott novels had never been published, and she hated the idea of first nights. She was not proud of her mother and what she did. It was not so surprising if Rosalind felt resentment too deep for acknowledgement about Agatha's career. It had helped to make Agatha the absent mother she undoubtedly was. In Rosalind's eyes, it may have contributed to the breakdown of her marriage to Archie. She left him alone too much. And the portrayal of Rosalind herself in Unfinished Portrait and, to a lesser extent, A Daughter's a Daughter, was appallingly clear-eyed. Reading those books, there could be no denying that Agatha was writer first, mother second. With Matthew, Agatha was very different. She had adored him from the first for the happy optimist's nature to which the death of Hubert lent poignancy. Her effusive delight in the lovely boy contrasted starkly with her cool, joshing relationship with Rosalind. "Mummy won't have got writer's cramp from writing to me," she wrote to Matthew. "Tell her this." Subconsciously, this emphatic adulation of Matthew may have been aimed at Rosalind. Agatha would not be the first to use a beloved grandchild in this way. Women who have been semi-detached mothers quite often become devoted grandmothers, almost as if to prove to their children that they can be maternal. And there is no doubt that Agatha found Matthew more congenial than she did Rosalind. As a cheerful boy at Eton, as a handsome young man at Oxford, she loved his company. She took him to school in her Rolls Royce, watched him play cricket at Lord's, whisked him off to Stratford. "I'm going to take Matthew," she wrote to Rosalind. "I'm telling you this, not asking, because you'll make a fuss and say no." And indulged their shared love of Wagner at Bayreuth. In many ways, he resembled Agatha far more than his mother, although physically, he took after Rosalind and Archie. Rosalind did not exude joy of living. She could not help but be sardonic with her son, "My poor little half-wit," as she called him in a 1944 letter to Agatha. She was not overly maternal. Agatha was afraid that Rosalind would love her dogs more than Matthew, says John Mallowan. Somewhat ironic, considering that Agatha had called her own dog Peter "my child." But in fact, like many people with a demonstrative love for animals, Rosalind had strong emotions towards humans that she found difficult to show. As a child, she had longed for her father, but had been obliged to keep this to herself. She had tried to get her mother's attention with her droll, sad letters, but had lost out to Max. Now, in adulthood, she continued to play a strange role within the family, a still young and highly attractive woman living in what was, however agreeable, a marriage of convenience, with a father whose name could not be mentioned, and a mother to whom she must act as perpetual handmaiden. Where, in the midst of all this, was Rosalind's own life? At the same time, she was an absolute pragmatist, another difference between her and her mother. She knew very well that Agatha's writing had bought them all a magnificent existence. If she and Anthony had the problems of Greenway, they also had Greenway. If they had the worry of how to deal with the money, they also had money. So the handmaiden existence was the only one possible. But Rosalind's resentment glinted dangerously when it came to Agatha Christie Limited, which had been brought into being for her own benefit, and that of her husband and child. The way the trust worked was for Agatha to be its employee and to be paid a yearly salary. In letters to Rosalind, Edmund Cork referred to "our servant" in a joking way, as if thereby to emphasize that Agatha was still, in fact, her own mistress. Rosalind, however, had no such scruples. "I am glad that Agatha Christie Limited is gathering some money, and sincerely hope it won't all be paid to our wage slave." This also reads like a joke, but it was not. "I hope you won't pay too much of the £14,000 in salary to my mother," she wrote to Cork, who had told her that the company had collected this sum during its first year of operation. By 1958, the company had accumulated £45,000. Cork suggested that Agatha's salary be raised from £5,000 to £7,500. "I think, of course, it is a very bad idea indeed, but if you think it won't be acceptable to the income tax at £5,000 with the £3,000 a year expenses, it will obviously have to be considered." It was true that, in a sense, the yearly salary was a formality paid to fulfill the conditions of the tax avoidance scheme. Agatha had still had the money from the sale of her copyrights, although this, like everything else she owned, was potentially up for grabs by the Inland Revenue. But Rosalind's attitude was extraordinary nonetheless, and Edmund Cork was baffled by it. When Agatha was paid £10,000 for her draft script of Bleak House, he wrote cautiously that "it would be nice to show the company's appreciation by paying her, say, another £5,000. Back came the reply, "I am not sure about my mother having extra money, as I think Anthony told you on the telephone, and we'll have to think about it. I'm glad you have got £10,000, though." Rosalind did agree that Agatha might have a new car. Collins had previously given her a huge Humber, which had been nothing but trouble. But it was quite some time before Cork prevailed about the additional £5,000. And yet for all this, Rosalind was powerfully protective of Agatha. In February 1957, she wrote to Cork about an article that had appeared in the Daily Mail. "I was most upset to see a reference to her disappearance. It said, of a missing woman, 'I'm not sure she's not doing an Agatha Christie on us. I don't know whether you can make some complaint about this. It makes me very angry, and I know it will not please my mother. I really do feel very strongly about it." The events of 1926 were always extremely sensitive for Rosalind. For mixed reasons, of course. She herself had a good deal to forgive about the behaviour of both her parents, and she was also obliged to maintain the semi-fiction of the official theory. At the same time, her instinctive reaction, when the subject arose, was to rise to her mother's defence. She could not bear Agatha to be defamed or ridiculed. She knew something of the agony that her mother had endured at that time, and it literally pained her to have this belittled. The unspoken subject, as Joan Oates calls it, was a test to be passed in order to be admitted over Rosalind's personal threshold. Anyone who regarded Agatha's behaviour as deceitful or attention-seeking would have the door shut upon them. Judith Gardner had been a childhood friend of Rosalind. Her mother, Nan Conn, had been Agatha's friend. And when Nan died in 1959, Agatha wrote to Judith to say, "If ever you need help or anything from an older person, I'm always there, and you must consider me as a kind of mother." Yet in 1996, Judith collaborated with Jared Cade on the book that purported to have solved the disappearance, unequivocally calling it a stunt. Rosalind, who viewed Judith's behaviour as a personal vendetta against her family, was distressed and disgusted. Oddly enough, Agatha herself had learned in 1960 that a journalist, Richie Calder, was preparing to write a book containing his memories of Agatha's discovery at Harrogate. Her reaction, as expressed to Edmund Cork, was sanguine. "You may worry it's coming to my ears," she wrote, "but after all, it's only what crops up from time to time every few years. And what does it matter after all this time?" This may, of course, have been partly bravura. At any rate, Rosalind would have sought to keep such stories from Agatha. She was also perversely protective of her mother's work. She reacted fiercely to attacks upon the books, of which there were many after Agatha's death, although such was their success that she could easily have left them to speak for themselves. But she felt Agatha Christie was much misunderstood, as in the Channel 4 J'accuse programme, which upset her greatly. Until her own death in 2004, Rosalind felt an obligation to stand up for her mother's books. When she was no longer a power within Agatha Christie Limited, and raged at some of what was done in its name, she would protest against what she saw as absurd, inappropriate, or insufficiently faithful adaptations. The accomplished BBC television series, starring Joan Hickson as Miss Marple, earned her delighted praise. The ITV series of Poirot was accepted on the whole, but she could not understand its occasional lack of fidelity. The closer the adaptation stuck to the originals, the better, was Rosalind's belief. And on the whole, she was right. But her belief was held out of loyalty as well as conviction. She believed it because she knew that it was what Agatha herself had wanted. She remembered, for example, the real misery that the MGM adaptations had caused her mother. Agatha had tried not to take this to heart, but she had minded very much indeed, and in March 1964, Rosalind wrote to Cork, "I feel personally most discouraged and ashamed about the dealings with MGM. Larry Barkman knew he had been wrong both legally and morally over this film. You may say, as you have done constantly over the last few days, that it is all good money, but I do feel, and I was really genuinely dismayed to see that you did not share my feelings, that we have really let my mother down very badly over this whole deal." The following year she wrote again, "I am very worried about my mother's tax. The chief concern is for my mother. She is not looking very well, and I know this is bothering her a lot." It was as though Rosalind felt guilt about Agatha, not just about how hard her mother had to work for them all, but about her own resentment of this work, for which she knew she had to be grateful. In order for Agatha to write, Rosalind had to help run the rest of Agatha's life. This was the way things were, and it aroused in Rosalind a complexity of emotions that, being the kind of person she was, she did not voice or even acknowledge. But the protectiveness that she showed towards Agatha was partly connected to her feelings of guilt. A way to expunge them, in fact, and to prove to herself how wrongful they were. As Agatha grew older, so Rosalind became more protective. After her mother's death, she became as fierce as a lioness in Agatha's defence, and never wavered in her staunch support of both the woman and the writer. "Even if I am her daughter, I think she was an exceptional person," she wrote. Like her mother, Rosalind was the product of an age that did not pity itself in public. Unlike her mother, she had the unusual ability to accept whatever life threw at her and deal with it as simple fact. She was the daughter of Agatha Christie, and that brought with it things that were both good and bad. Fact. She has been called damaged, difficult, terms that she herself would not have recognized, and that bear little relation to the warm, highly intelligent, straight-talking woman she was in old age. It is true that her childhood would nowadays be regarded as blighted. No regular contact with her father, left for months on end while her mother went travelling, sidelined in favour of a stepfather of an age to be her own husband. And it is also true that her adulthood, after Hubert's death, was not really her own to enjoy. But it was also true that she had a glorious life through her mother's success. This, then, was the way things were. Rather than discussing them, it was better to have a large gin. Unlike Agatha, Rosalind was no abstainer. It was said that life at Greenway revolved around drink. And get on with it. For her part, Agatha found her feelings hard to express when it came to Rosalind. The letter that she sent from the East during the 1950s took their usual tone. "It will probably make you gnash your teeth to read it, but I am having a very pleasant life," she wrote from Baghdad. "And after a visit to Tunis, lucky for you, you weren't born in the days of Carthage. They sacrificed all their firstborn children. There are thousands and thousands of holes full of little bleached bones." At the same time, she wanted to hear from her child. "Sophia's shock for the postman, bringing a letter from you. Over 3 weeks here, and not one word from you. Yours truly, fed up." In 1955, Agatha was taken ill on the dig, with what Max described to Rosalind as an internal chill. In fact, a very unpleasant infection, and driven for 3.5 hours to hospital at Kirkuk. From there she wrote, "What a rotten correspondent you are. I take it very poorly. Now that I'm only the servant of the company, I shall have to be kept in a good temper and induced by a great deal of kindness to do some work. Lots of love to you, really, you horrid girl." Agatha knew the debt she owed to Rosalind. She, too, felt a good deal of guilt. Since 1926, her actions had influenced her daughter's life, by no means always in the way that Rosalind would have chosen. She still believed that her divorce was a very wrong thing, and that in some way she was to blame for it. She knew that Rosalind saw Archie and was grateful for the discretion with which this was done. She realized that her second marriage had relegated Rosalind to a minor role, and that her daughter stoically stoked the home fires while she and Max lived pretty much as they chose. At the same time, Agatha was aware, as how could she not be, that it was her money which paid for everything, and this made her autocratic. Although her facade was modest, she could be grand. Not with everyone, but often with Edmund Cork, and sometimes with Rosalind. In the years of her great fame, she tended to conduct her affairs with a rather irritable airiness thus. "Do go to Greenway sometimes to see how it's all going, but don't go out of your way to make trouble. The great thing is, nobody writes and bothers me." She left Rosalind and Anthony to deal with Greenway. "Tell Anthony bending the back to pick lettuces is the best cure for those aches and pains and stiffness," she wrote from Nimrod. And a part of her thought that this was right and proper. Another part of her felt differently. On a visit to Puillerac, a row erupted about Greenway, and Agatha, as she put it, blew her top in its defence. Afterwards, she wrote to Rosalind to apologise. "The truth is, I've got a guilty conscience about Greenway. You and Anthony and Matthew have Puillerac, a lovely home and garden, and Max has his Winterbrook and its books and its river. and it's really only I who cling on to Greenway because I love it so. I feel a bit better since the garden's done so well, thanks to Anthony, but of course I suppose it is pure selfishness on my part. There is no doubt that, far from being a rum barber, I am a bloody old bitch. She loved the house with a deep and private passion. It absorbed some of the feelings she had had for Ashfield. It could never quite replace that home. Ashfield would always be the place where she had been most entirely at ease and most entirely happy. But Greenway laid a sharp, exquisite touch upon her imagination. In the summer, it was often filled with people. Names of the visitors' book include members of the Mallowan family, Alan and Lettice Lane, Billy Collins, Peter Saunders, Stephen Glanville and his daughter Lucia, Charlotte Fisher, Nan Conn, Edmund Cork, Stella Kerwin, from the 1950s, Agatha's secretary and friend, A.L. Rouse. And filled with activity. Tennis, croquet, clock golf, boats on the dart, children playing in the sun, dogs scurrying everywhere. Yet it was a place where solitude could become something magical. The walled gardens, the tangled paths, the brief-blooming camellias, the sunlit shadows within the shuttered rooms, the lawn outside the front door dropping away to the dart. A scene of configurative stillness rustled by trees. There was a serenity to the whole that was nonetheless disturbed by its beauty, a beauty so extreme that it did not quite permit restfulness. It demanded imaginative response. This was Agatha's dreamscape, and through it she walked, a fat and wrinkled lady with shrewd eyes and a black and tan dog at her heels. A country gentlewoman, it might be said. But in her head, what mysterious thoughts. So she was intensely grateful to Rosalind and to Anthony, whom she adored, for the help with the house, and indeed with everything. "Oh, dear Rosalind, what a relief," she wrote in 1953, after hearing that the Hickses were taking charge of her affairs while she was at Nimroot. "I can now apply myself to the important development of after the funeral." Beneath the dry surface of their relationship, Agatha recognized Rosalind's worth, increasingly so as she grew older. "I feel you really must have a proper letter thanking you for the lovely Christmas you gave us. I know, too, that a lot of work and planning and thought has to be done to make everything seem so right and so effortless, and I appreciate it." At Nimroot, she began to miss her English life. Days of whirling dust storms have been sitting gasping and longing for home. Crocuses, snowdrops, camellias at Greenway, river at Wallingford, you and Matthew at Quillerac. Somewhere green, where there is a flower or two. Can't think why I ever wanted to come to this stupid country. In 1957, she wrote describing her attempt to type Max's catalogue with a tornado hurling itself against the door and panes of glass smashing into the dig house, then going to a bed, partly protected by a Macintosh. "That, visitors, sandflies, peculiar beetles, and now mosquitoes, have curbed my enthusiasm a good deal. And to read of your daffodils makes me long for Quillerac, and you and Anthony, and possibly a Japanese poem or two. Well, not long now." But Agatha went to Nimroot to be with Max, as well as to escape the oppressions of England. There would be no leaving Max alone out east. She would never leave her husband alone again. Rosalind knew the depth of Agatha's loyalty to her husband, the extent to which she used her own career to support his, and this played a part in her desire to protect her mother. It may, too, have influenced Rosalind's desire to cap the salary that Agatha Christie Limited paid to her mother every year. This money, after all, was spent on Agatha's life with Max. The travel, the trips to Rome and Paris, the nights at the Hotel Bristol, and sumptuous French dinners. A Chateau Latour, 1924, bang on, as Max wrote to Rosalind in 1953. Complete with Chateaubriand, sauce béarnaise, and all the French cheeses. Price of wine, 1,600 francs. The more salary Agatha was given as spending money, the more she would do this kind of thing. It is usually said that Rosalind was very fond of Max, although there is no particular evidence one way or the other. "He didn't beat me or my mother, not that I remember," she said of him. Certainly he had a liking for her, as shown in his letters during the war, and he got along very well with Anthony. Both were intellectual men, with a shared love of good conversation and wine. Rosalind's own feelings were more opaque. Her Aunt Madge, who died in 1950, had never trusted Max. Neither did Madge's son, Jack. A tricky character, but highly intelligent. They were wary of a young, impoverished man and Catholic who had sought to marry a much older woman of considerable means. There is no evidence that Rosalind shared their view. Arguably, she might have resented the fact that Uncle Max took her mother off on digs, and she got popped into school and got looked after by Agatha's secretary, things like that, says John Mallowan. Although, in fact, she coped very well with the considerable upheaval of her mother's second marriage. But it does seem that she came in later years to distrust one particular aspect of Max's behaviour. Nobody knows for certain if Max Mallowan had a long-term affair with Barbara Parker, the woman who organised the dig at Nimrud, and whom he married less than 2 years after Agatha's death. Such a liaison, if it happened, was inevitably conducted with secrecy. It was also surrounded by rumour and gossip, some of which appears to have reached Rosalind's ears and very possibly Agatha's too. Was it the case that, despite her best efforts to stay with her second husband and to keep him happy in every way, Max had betrayed her, just as Archie had? Although she was 18 years younger than Agatha, and obviously far less of a personage, Barbara Parker was an interesting woman in her own right, highly singular, in fact. In Jared Cade's version of Agatha's life, which naturally takes the view that Max and Barbara did have an affair, Barbara is portrayed as somewhat pathetic. A hard-working spinster, whose compliant nature and dog-like devotion to Max masked unfulfilled sexual needs. This is presumably the view of Judith Gardner and her husband Graham, but it is not the way she is generally remembered. "Rather magnificent, Barbara," says Julian Reed, who was a young archaeologist in the 1960s. "She had a reverberating whisper, so that 'he's one of them' would go ringing across the room." "I adored Barbara," says Joan Oates, who shared a tent with her on the Nimrud dig. "She was an unusual person, a bit of a character. You could almost put her on a list of extraordinary British women who spent a lot of time in the Near East, going back to people like Lady Hester Stanhope. She was in that mould. She was terrific. A little bit odd, but you had to be to live that sort of life." The way in which Barbara fell into the world of archaeology shows how small it was, yet wide open to those with enthusiasm, in the pre-war years. She saw the announcement of a course in Western Asian archaeology on a notice board at the Courthold, where she was studying Chinese. Before this, she had worked as a mannequin at Worth and gone to RADA. Now she decided to enroll upon this course. The only other student was Rachel Maxwell Hislop, who says, "The course existed on paper only. Nobody had ever asked to do it. But with the encouragement of Stephen Glanville, bless his heart, the two women went to see Sidney Smith at the British Museum, with whom they would study cuneiform. He was amazed. In actual fact, he was so amazed, he was marvellous. Smith gave tutorials after hours at the museum, sending his students to sources that were only published in German, which neither of them read. Although, later, they were joined by another female student who was fortunately bilingual." Rachel Maxwell Hislop was a highly educated postgraduate with a mind attuned to academic study. Barbara was nothing of the kind, but she completed the 2-year course, and although, according to Henrietta McCall's biography of Max Mallowan, she was never taken terribly seriously by her colleagues, she evidently possessed a good and inquisitive brain. "Archaeology was so alive at that time," says Rachel Maxwell Hislop, whose fascination with the subject had been fired by hearing Leonard Woolley lecture. He'd put up slides, say, "This is the flood." Very exciting. You never knew what was going to come up, and there were very few people in it. We all knew each other, and everybody had come in odd ways. When Max was appointed to the Institute of Archaeology, Rachel Maxwell Hislop became an assistant lecturer, and Barbara, who had worked in Palestine just before the war, was shot out to Baghdad in 1949, there to run the BSA house. By then, Max had known her for some time. A wartime letter to Agatha tells her to ask Barbara, then working for the fire service in London, to send Herodotus out to Tripolitania. When she arrived in Iraq, she had very little Arabic, but she learned quickly, and she got on well with the Arabs. Her connections within Iraq society were invaluable to Max Mallowan. You couldn't get anywhere in Baghdad without knowing the right person, and if things were ever difficult, then Barbara would know the right person one should ask to dinner. So it was that Max reaped the benefits not just of Agatha's wealth and status, but of Barbara's insider knowledge. Barbara was lean and fine-boned, with an angular face and large, eloquent eyes. She was the physical model for Valerie Hobhouse in Hickory Dickory Dock. "Valerie, rather like Barbara," Agatha wrote in one of her notebooks. It had been said that Barbara was very alluring, although the general impression is that, unlike the rakishly attractive Valerie, she was not quite assured enough to be a femme fatale. John Mallowan remembers that at Greenway, you'd try and keep her away from plates and glasses because she was a bit clumsy. But a photograph taken on site at Nimrud shows a stark difference in the silhouettes of Barbara and Agatha. The one with the slightly drooping heron-like stance of the former mannequin, the other massive as an aging bull. "Barbara wasn't really elegant," says Joe Notes. "She was a bit bizarre. She wore Kurdish trousers, but she was tall and very slim. And she clearly had some attraction for the eminent Arabs with whom she mixed so easily. On one occasion, in the 1950s, she was taken to court in Baghdad, accused of flouting a new law, which said that sewage could no longer be dumped in the Tigris, although with houses like the BSA residence, whose drains ran into the river, there was no simple alternative. And then she was summoned," says Joe Notes. "She had no lawyer. She had decided to defend the case herself, in her Arabic, which was quite good by then, and she defended herself in court, and she was found not guilty, and the judge took her out to lunch." Similarly, Agatha wrote to Rosalind in 1951 of "our Barbara, now on great terms of intimacy with Sheikh Abdullah, from whom she had collected 12 turkeys, a set of divan pillows with variegated satin ends, and a prism." Joe Notes met Barbara for the first time in 1952, when they were both staying in the BSA house, awaiting the arrival of Max and Agatha. The previous year, Max had told her to go and build a dig house, and she had gone up and built a house. In fact, she extended what was already there. Impressive. Back of beyond, she was on her own. She had to hire the labor. Max just told her to do these things. And anything difficult, she did beautifully. The simple things were always getting her sacked. This was the joke with Barbara. Max sacked her every day. She was, wrote Robert Hamilton, a classical scholar who worked on a dig. The good-natured butt of Max's occasional satirical humor. She was also the target of his volatile temper. Although a capable epigraphist, she was not a naturally concentrated worker. "Her notebooks of the period have a harried look about them," said Henrietta McCall. And Max, for whatever reason, constantly blew off steam in her direction. In 1955, Agatha wrote to Rosalind that lots of imposing tablets were turning up on the dig, and that Barbara was consequently very busy and full of gloom. "I knew this would happen if you had no epigraphist but me, actually doing very well with constant goading by Max." So she was capable of the hard scholarly work of deciphering cuneiform, but her real talents lay in her ability to understand and penetrate Iraqi society. Even after the 1958 revolution, the contracts Barbara had made held good. The BSA owed her for that, says Rachel Maxwell Hislop. It was a difficult job, starting off with being a woman in the first place. But she did a good deal else besides, almost to the point of masochism. Max, it was said, knew the extent of her devotion, whether to the work or to himself, and used it. For example, she would pay the workmen on the dig. Once it was said she had forgotten to go to the bank, paid the first man, then asked him if she could borrow the money to pay the second, borrowed again and so on, to the end of the line. She was ingenious, says Joan Oates. She would also do the accounts, although they never came out right, and would put in her own money, of which she had little, to make the totals fit. Whereas Max would come along and say, I need some money for the trip up to Kirkuk to take some money off this oil company. About £200 will do. It was in the winter of 1952 that Barbara took Joan on a trip from Baghdad to Mosul in order to get fruit trees for the terrace on the dig house. And then it starts to pour with rain, really dumping rain. And once it starts to rain like this, the roads were just impassable. But she had to do this because Agatha wanted trees. In the end, Barbara persuaded two policemen to take her to Nimrud, about 30 kilometres from Mosul. And we get to Nimrud, and Barbara gets the policemen to dig the holes for the trees. Agatha and Barbara were friends, although not intimates. They seemed to have liked each other well enough. A Barbara type, good company, read another note in one of Agatha's books. The two women travelled together each year from Baghdad to Nimrud. We go up like ladies a few days after the men. But as the story of the fruit trees shows, Barbara also worked for Agatha, and Agatha was always in the position to command. Back in England, Barbara had a fairly solitary life, living as she did in her nephew's flat in Kensington. The visitor's book at Greenway shows that every year, almost without fail, she spent 2 or 3 weeks at the house from August to September. If she was there for Max, she was also there at Agatha's invitation, beholden to Agatha's hospitality, rather as Nancy Neal had once been on her visit to Styles. But was Barbara there for Max? Joan Oates says categorically not. I don't believe the story of the affair at all. I lived in the house at Baghdad, and it was a house where all the bedrooms opened into the inner courtyard. I shared a tent with her at Nimrud. I really knew her quite well. The story actually originated with somebody who stayed in the house at Baghdad. It was a mischievous story. Joan Oates was married to the subsequent dig director in 1956, after which she would not, of course, have shared a tent with Barbara. Nonetheless, she is adamant in her belief that there was no affair, and so too is John Mallowan, who is clear and calm on the subject. I remember Judy and Graham Gardner, and I think they just got it totally wrong. I don't think there was anything between Barbara and Uncle Max. They were good friends, and they shared an interest, so getting married after Agatha died was a logical thing to do. And Barbara helped Uncle Max with Agatha towards the end, and rendered genuine assistance. Barbara was always. She was a very faithful person. I think Uncle Max always tried to do his best for her work-wise. I think he may have had some influence in what job she got, but I think that's as far as it went. Other people who knew Barbara and Max are of this opinion, that they were friends and no more, and that they married in November 1977 to assuage each other's loneliness. A photograph of the two together does have a marital look, although it was taken in the 1960s. They are on a sofa in an unidentified sitting room, possibly out east. Max reading comfortably in his slippers, Barbara close to him, smiling at the camera, with a bottle of Gordon's gin on a cushion at her side. They look not exactly blissful, but familiar with each other. And there are those who say that this familiarity was born of a long-standing love affair, which, after 30 years or so, was finally regularized in marriage. One friend does not state that there was definitely an affair, but comes close to asserting his own belief in it. What people say, meaning those who deny the affair, may be the truth in their eyes, which may have involved a certain amount of turning a blind eye. Judith and Graham Gardner did not go in for blind eye turning. In the course of their collaboration with Jared Cade, they regaled him with tales of Max's infidelity, and not just with Barbara. They say, for example, that Max conducted affairs with the young female students at the Institute of Archaeology after he was appointed lecturer-teacher in 1947. There is absolutely no evidence whatsoever of this. According to Julian Reed, Max hardly had any students anyway. He remembers just one of note, a talented young Iraqi, whose PhD was published with Max's help. So the idea that a cluster of young girls was fluttering around him is entirely misleading. According to the Gardners, however, Judith's mother, Nan, discovered that Max was conducting casual liaisons and broke the news to Agatha. Nan had approached Max for advice after a friend's daughter was uncertain how to pursue an interest in archaeology. Max had offered to help by giving the girl a place in his class, and although he formed no relationship with her, reports of his friendships with other female students got back to the girl's mother, who in turn told Nan. The omnipresence of Nan in Agatha's life, which Cade's book requires the reader to accept, as Nan is the source of almost every one of its stories, is simply not borne out by facts. The two women were good friends, certainly. Nan's name is the first entry in the visitor's book at Greenway. Good luck to Greenway and Agatha and Max. Lots of love, Nansky. But also there at the time was Dorothy North, and Nan features no more than she in Agatha's correspondence. Max refers to her during the war, saying that he owes her a letter. Agatha mentions her as an entertaining dinner guest who amused Alan Lane into the small hours. But although Agatha wrote to Judith, "I shall miss her very much," after Nan's death in 1959, there is no sense that she was an intimate friend of the kind that Jared Cade implies. Agatha was simply not the type to have confiding relationships. For all her dependency on Max, she was in many ways a proud, grand, self-contained creature, and it is impossible to imagine her having hushed little female discussions about her husband's infidelity over the teacups in Chelsea. It is said that Max had an eye for a pretty girl. In Baghdad, for example, he apparently became quite smitten with the glamorous wife of an ambassador. But this is quite usual behavior among men, not necessarily meaningful, and certainly out east the shrewd eye of Joan Oates saw nothing untoward. Yet the very nature of the Mallowan marriage might well have led Max towards other women. It was not just that Agatha was growing old while he was merely middle-aged. It was something more subtle. The money was Agatha's, the houses were Agatha's, the patronage was Agatha's, and everybody knew it. In such circumstances, which in less exaggerated form are quite familiar, it is not uncommon for a man to take something that is definitely his own. That is to say, a mistress. There were hints in Agatha's earlier letters that Max might want to look elsewhere from time to time, and that she would accept him doing so. Agatha knew the nature of her marriage. It was not a great romance. The age difference was very considerable, and she was a woman without physical allure, although Max was not abundant in this quality. The truth was that Max simply did not have the power to hurt her as Archie had done. A dalliance or two she could take. The only pain she could not endure was to be left alone again, and she did not ever really believe that that would happen. Even if she were Max's mistress, Barbara was not a threat. She could offer nothing to compare with the life Max had with Agatha. "Nevertheless," writes Jared Cade, "Agatha still grieved over the loss of Max's love for her." A statement without a shred of supporting evidence, although the assumption must be that Agatha spoke of her grief to that all-knowing confidant, Nan Conn. More concrete evidence, albeit uncorroborated, comes from Graham Gardner, who visited Baghdad with his wife in 1962. Although the Mallowans were not there at the time, the couple stayed at the BSA house, and Graham photographed some of the Nimrod treasures. According to his account, he went to Swan Court before leaving for Baghdad to receive instructions from Max as to the photographs he was to take. At the flat, he found that his arrival was unexpected, and that Max and Barbara were furtively ensconced in a lover's tryst. The precise meaning of this is unclear. Barbara lived not far away in Kensington, and unless Graham Gardner caught her and Max in flagrante, which he would surely have mentioned, it is entirely possible that she was visiting Max as a friend and colleague. Nor is there any evidence for the statement made by the Gardners that Max was keeping Barbara, presumably with Agatha's money. As Henrietta McCall writes, she was Max's slave, his secretary, and generally indispensable aid, so if he helped her in return, this would be in the nature of things. The Gardners also say that the affair was conducted at Winterbrook House. This, again, is hard to prove. It was said, not by the Gardners, that on Barbara's visits to Greenway, she and Max would shut themselves away for long periods in the library, leaving Barbara's plimsolls outside the door as a sign that they should not be disturbed. But the truth is that nobody knows what went on between Max and Barbara. As with the disappearance, so with the affair. Jared Cade's book presents a weight of unsubstantiated claims as if they were undisputed facts. That said, Max's behavior after Agatha's death was not quite that of a grief-stricken widower. It was said by the Gardners that he was impatient for Agatha to die so that he could marry Barbara. In fact, he had an eye elsewhere, notably on the wildly glamorous Baroness Camoys, who lived close to Winterbrook at the magnificent Stoner Park near Henley, one of the great Catholic houses. Jean Camoys Stoner was born in 1913, the product of an illegitimate mating between the daughter of an Irish viscount and a Spanish grandee. She was a genuine thoroughbred beauty, capable of dazzling men with her charm, but she had a lethal streak. She swore like a stevedore, "And you can if off out of it," supported the Nazis unashamedly during the war, "Ole and Heil Hitler," and treated her kindly husband with something close to contempt. She cultivated Agatha and Max, her rich and famous neighbours, and when her husband died in March 1976, she saw in the recently bereaved Max a suitable replacement. Her calculation was that Agatha would have left him millions. The situation was, of course, rather more complex, but it seems that for a short time in 1976, Max did see himself as the likely husband of this lurid and exotic man-eater. Then, for whatever reason, perhaps his friends advised him that it would not look entirely suitable, perhaps Jean learned that Max was not so cash-rich as she had believed, Max quit the Stoner scene. He had a less tricky companion than Lady Camoys in the young girl Dee, aged around 20, whom he befriended very soon after Agatha's death. She had asked if she could graze her pony in the grounds at Winterbrook. Agatha was very ill at the time, but after she had died, Max contacted the girl, and they quickly became close. He drove her in his Mercedes to lunch at Boodle's. "There was me, just in my scruffy clothes," and he would suddenly whisk her off for ice cream at Fortnum and Mason, where he parked outside, practically on Piccadilly. Max's cars were always flamboyant. In the 1950s, he drove a silver Rolls-Royce, a monster of a machine, according to John Mallowan, in which he would do around 70 miles per hour on the curving road along Slapton Sands in Devon, and he was known for driving right in the middle of the road. In the end, Dee drove the Bentley, taking Max down to Greenway in it, stopping on the way for sherry and sardine sandwiches, and resisting his urges to see if it would do 130 miles per hour. So Dee became a regular visitor to Greenway, and for about 6 months went to live in the Mews house at Cresswell Place that Agatha had bought in 1928. Max was worried about squatters, so he said, "Why don't you go and live in my house?" He also suggested that she might go to Iran with him, and act sort of like a hostess, taking him around and all that. This, for Max, was obviously in the nature of a dream. By that time, his days of swanning around the East were over. There was nothing whatsoever improper about his relationship, although it was not perhaps what might have been expected at that time. It was in the nature of an innocent last fling. D had the impression that Agatha was a bit tricky towards the end, that it was a bit of a relief to Max when she died. I would think the last 2 or 3 years of Agatha's life were tough on him. So he conducted himself like an aging, still frisky dog let off the leash. He enjoyed his old role of teacher. He was a mentor to me, and particularly with this very young, direct, fearless girl, who was unimpressed by his considerable standing and knew nothing of his achievements. I just sit there and say, "Well, what did you do then?" Doubtless this amused him a good deal. After so many years of ingratiation and social climbing and academic politicking, after a life spent as Mr. Agatha Christie, how very refreshing it must have been to nip into the Bentley with this bright and unpretentious young thing, play King Cophetua, and show her a jolly good time. Certainly she remembers him with great fondness. Everyone should have a Max in their life. It was like a picnic. Dee knew Barbara, of course, who was always around. Rachel Maxwell Hislop remembers Barbara saying, "I can't do anything at weekends," because she was looking after Max at Winterbrook. She was great. She was a real case. She drove Rosalind mad because she wouldn't eat this, she wouldn't eat that. She had this wonderful old fur coat. It was quite raggedy, but she'd wear it in the summer because she felt the cold. I think that used to annoy Rosalind as well. Rosalind, she says, used to like to talk about Agatha, but she was very possessive, very, very possessive of her memory. Dee obviously detected Rosalind's antipathy towards Barbara. It was with some trepidation that Max told his stepdaughter of his plans to remarry. "No one will ever take the place of my dear Agatha," he wrote in March 1977, "but I think she would have approved, for she used to tell me to marry in case anything happened to her. It is lonely now, and will not be so with Barbara, who has always been a devoted friend." "It was just obvious that he should marry Barbara," says Dee, "because she was spending so much time there. He said, 'I'm tempted to ask you.' Thank God he didn't. No, there was never anything. I mean, I used to get teased." Jared Cade's book gives the impression that Barbara was desperate to marry Max, but Dee, who was at Winterbrook much of the time, says, "She wasn't bothered. I heard her saying, 'It's so silly, so silly. I know he'll look after me.' But Max wanted to marry her as a thank you." Max and Barbara lived together for barely a year at Winterbrook House. Their companion was the dog Bingo, Agatha's second Manchester Terrier, who in her declining years had been viewed by a watchful friend as her ally. When Max died in August 1978, Barbara was left £40,000, with which she eventually bought a house in Wallingford, where she lived alone until her death in 1993. Winterbrook was sold. This caused Rosalind a good deal of anguish, as the house was full of things that had belonged to Agatha, even to Archie, whose ownership she had constantly to prove. "It must be understood that under the terms of my mother's will, she left all her personal possessions to me," she wrote to Cecil Mallowan, Max's brother, in 1981. "Secondly, under Max's will, I was able to choose certain ornaments particularly associated with my mother after Barbara left the house. I have always known and agreed that Winterbrook was Max's house." Perhaps there is little wonder that Dee remembers Rosalind at the lunch after Max's funeral, going around Winterbrook saying, "That's mine, that's mine." Nor is it hard to understand why Rosalind became ever more protective towards Agatha as her mother grew older and even more alert to the fate of Agatha's legacy. Yet Agatha's own attitude was rather different. Whatever she suspected about her second husband, that he had married her for money, that he was unfaithful, that he would quickly remarry if she predeceased him, she remained defiantly on Max's side. In 1971, she sent a long letter to Rosalind on the subject of her plays. Rosalind was urging her against a new production of Fiddler's Five, a late work that had been poorly received. The letter ended, "I know you have my best interests at heart. As AP, Madge, had when she implored me not to marry Max, and even refused to come to the wedding. I'm thankful I didn't listen to her. 40 years of happiness I should have missed. If one doesn't take a few risks in life, one might as well be dead." This, then, was Agatha's stance. Max made her happy, which may mean that Max was not having a long-term affair with Barbara Parker, and that the Mallowan marriage was mutually devoted until the end. That is the way that Max portrayed it in his memoirs. Or it may be that Max was having an affair, and Agatha knew nothing of it, although the Gardners insist she was aware of it all along. Or it may mean something more complex, more mature, more accepting. The evidence for this is in Agatha's writing, so often the key to her mysterious character. Her play Verdict, which was produced in 1958, was not a success. It was booed on its first night and ran for just 4 weeks. It was not an Agatha Christie play. There was no puzzle, no denouement. It was a human drama. Carl, a middle-aged professor, is married to Anya, an invalid. One of Carl's young students, Helen, falls in love with him so passionately that she murders his wife, justifying it as an act of philanthropic euthanasia. Another woman, Lisa, is accused of the crime. She is the wife's companion. She and the professor are in love, although their passion is suppressed and not acted upon. "Every month, every year, she gets a little weaker," Lisa says of the wife. "She may go on like that for many, many years." "It's tough on him," is the reply. "As you say," says Lisa, "it is tough on him." Of Helen, the student, Lisa says, "She has fallen in love with Carl, of course, but she does not think that he will respond." Indeed, he does not. "How little you understand," he says to Helen, when she makes her blatant play for him. "You talk like a child. I love my wife." The girl cannot understand this, saying that he may have loved Anya once, but that now she is old and her life as a sexual being is over. She is no longer the same person. "Carl, she is. We don't change. There is the same Anya still. Life does things to us. Ill health, disappointment, exile, all these things form a crust covering over the real self. But the real self is still there." Helen: "I think you're talking nonsense. If it were a real marriage, but it isn't. It can't be, in the circumstances." Carl: "It is a real marriage." Towards the end of the play, Carl confesses to Anya's doctor that he is in love with Lisa. Carl: "I love her. Did you know I loved her?" Doctor: "Yes, of course I knew. You've loved her for a long time." Carl: "It didn't mean that I didn't love Anya. I did love Anya. I shall always love Anya. I didn't want her to die." Doctor: "I know, I know. I've never doubted that." Carl: "It's strange, perhaps, but one can love two women at the same time." Doctor: "Not at all strange. It often happens. And you know what Anya used to say to me. When I'm gone, Carl must marry Lisa." The Times wrote of Verdict that, although the play contained no surprises of the familiar Agatha Christie variety, it did have surprises of another kind, that people should behave as she makes them behave. The reviews in general were catty and patronizing, yet the play has aged well, better than theatrical successes like Spider's Web or even Witness for the Prosecution. It is true that both Carl and Helen behave in ways that are not realistic. Rather, they act according to their convictions. Carl seeks to protect Helen from an accusation of murder because, according to his philosophical belief, she lacked the capacity to realize what she had done. Life has not yet taught her understanding and compassion. but shielding Helen leads to Lisa being accused of murder instead. Thus Carl, who is a good man, is also dangerous. He lives according to ideas rather than realities, and in some way it is the blinkered dedication of his mind that makes him attractive to women. Agatha sees his foolishness, she also sees his virtue, and if this was not the truth about Max Mallowan, it was almost certainly the truth as Agatha perceived it. Was it also the truth about her marriage? Did Max love two women at the same time? Did he have feelings for Barbara, and did they, as in verdict, remain unconsummated during the lifetime of his wife? It is impossible to know how far Agatha wrote the facts of the situation into her play. Not fully is the most likely answer. Up to a point, she might have been deceiving herself, writing what she wanted to believe. Yet she faces a good deal in the play, and she does not give her life an easy ride. There is no reason to think she is sparing her own feelings about her marriage. She saw its realities in all their ambivalence, and unlike Anya in the play, she lived with them. During the war, she described to Max a dream in which he no longer wanted her, and she was left alone again. "I woke up in a panic and had to say over and over, 'It's not true, it's not true, I've got his letter.'" One letter in particular was kept in a secret drawer of a little desk at Greenway. It had been written to Agatha for her to receive on the 6th anniversary of her marriage, and it made her happy. I think that sometimes, but not so very often, two people find real love together as we do, and then it is something that lies deep and intangible, not to be shaken by the wind. "You are my dearest friend and my darling lover at the same time, and for me, you remain beautiful and precious as the passing of years. You have the sweetest face of anyone in the world. This is a lover's letter, darling, and I won't add anything more to it except that I don't think anyone can know how much we mean to one another."